Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present author and columnist Wajahat Ali, who examines Donald Trump's demonization of immigrants and white supremacist rhetoric that endangers lives, this time targeting Haitian immigrants in Springfield, Ohio. Alec Conan of Stop the Money Pipeline, who talks about what was accomplished in the 13-week Summer of Heat climate protest campaign that demanded Citibank and its financing of global fossil fuel projects. And rebel singer-songwriter Billy Bragg, who celebrated 40 years of making music in 2023, reflects on his career and the political activism that inspired many of his iconic songs of protest and solidarity. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Just hours after Apple unveiled its updated iPhone, Apple Watch, and AirPod product lines, Europe's top court, the European Court of Justice, ruled against the tech giant in a 10-year legal battle over its tax arrangements in Ireland, Apple's European home base. Apple must now reimburse Ireland up to 13 billion euros, or $14.4 billion, in back taxes because the company was judged to have received illegal tax breaks from Ireland over the course of two decades. The case centered on sweetheart deals that Dublin was offering to attract multinational businesses by lowering taxes in contrast to other states in the 27-nation bloc. The final decision by the EU's top court was hailed as a landmark victory over corporate greed. In March, Apple once again found itself in the EU's crosshairs when the European Commission hit Apple with an antitrust fine of 1.8 billion euros for abusing its dominant market position in the distribution of music streaming apps. Danish Green Party EU Member of Parliament Kira Peter Hansen observed that member states cannot continue the race to the bottom of corporate tax policies that undermine European unity and social cohesion. The right-wing Heritage Foundation's blueprint for the next Trump administration, known as Project 2025, could lead to a massive deregulation of federally owned public land and put millions of Native Americans at risk. For decades, Native American communities have been treated as sacrifice zones by the U.S. government, where tons of deadly radioactive waste and toxic chemicals have been dumped. As outlined in the Project 2025 chapter, written by former Trump Administration Bureau of Land Management official William Perry Pendley, the plan would deregulate up to 500 million acres of federal lands, including national parks and national wildlife refuges, and open up 700 million acres of subsurface minerals, as well as 1.7 billion acres of the outer continental shelf, to corporate mining extraction and exploitation. Rachel Cletus, the Union of Concerned Scientists policy director, calls Project 2025 stomach-churning to contemplate. She says, "Let's hope it never gets beyond a theoretical exercise in how to destroy our country and leave our children's futures dark and uncertain." Environmental advocacy groups have taken the Federal Environmental Protection Agency to court, challenging new rules on toxic air pollutants from chemical and plastic manufacturing plants. Concerned citizens of St. John and Rise St. James, Louisiana, are among the plaintiffs who cite concerns the EPA relied too heavily on unreliable industry data as it estimated the risks to people's health posed by ethylene oxide, chloroprene, and other toxic emissions. The Smog blog reports that the new EPA rules will directly impact 200 chemical plants across the U.S., heavily clustered along the Gulf of Mexico near black and brown communities. The EPA's own risk assessment found that 6 million people will be exposed to elevated cancer risks even after the EPA's new rule goes into effect. Back in April, the Smog blog first reported concerns that loopholes in the rules, combined with plans from companies like Koch Industries to expand their operations, could mean Louisiana's Cancer Alley won't see a decrease in total toxic air pollution. Earth Justice Attorney Dina Toomey said, "The EPA's underestimation of the risks posed by chemical facilities puts nearby communities in grave danger." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
In the week following his presidential debate with Vice President Kamala Harris, Donald Trump and his running mate J.D. Vance persistently repeated the lie that Haitian immigrants were eating people's pets in Springfield, Ohio, which incited multiple bomb threats targeting government buildings, schools, and hospitals. Trump, when asked by a reporter if he would denounce the bomb threats his lies inspired, the former president refused. The lie spread by Trump drew the attention of the far-right militia group, the Proud Boys, whose members were seen marching on Springfield streets. After the Secret Service prevented another assassin from taking a shot at Trump at his Palm Beach golf course, the Republican presidential candidate accused President Joe Biden and his opponent, Vice President Harris, of using rhetoric that caused him to be the target of a second assassination attempt, oblivious to the irony, given his long and well-documented history of inciting lethal political violence by his supporters over the past 9 years. Your reporter spoke with Wajahat Ali, author of Go Back to Where You Came From and creator of the Left Hook Substack page. Here he examines Donald Trump's demonization of immigrants and white supremacist rhetoric that has resulted in stochastic terrorism, this time endangering the lives of Haitian immigrants in Springfield, Ohio.
Yeah, it's always projection with Trump and MAGA. Every allegation is a confession. And for him, it's constant victimization, right? It's always pure victimhood. And that is the cultural anxiety that rallies most of his base, right? It's not economic anxiety, Scott. It's cultural anxiety, and the studies have shown it for the past 9 years. This feeling of being, quote-unquote, replaced by people of color, by women. And as we know, this is not the first time Trump and MAGA have promoted a neo-Nazi conspiracy theory that has led to terror threats. Right before the 2018 midterm election, Donald Trump just campaigned on one issue and one issue alone. Remember that? The hateful conspiracy of the invasion of migrants. And that led to, inspired a terrorist to commit violence against Jews at the Tree of Life Synagogue. He used the exact same language. It's part and parcel of the replacement theory, which has now gone mainstream in right-wing circles and in parts of America, which alleges that Jews are a part of an international cabal using people of color to weaken and replace Western civilization. So you've seen him double down on it with the Haitians and also with Venezuela, right? Even though it has been debunked, even though law enforcement has debunked it, city officials have debunked it, even after they were told, J.D. Vance and Trump, that there are bomb threats, you saw Donald Trump whining and complaining about, you know, the use of this incendiary language when he was given the opportunity over the weekend to condemn a bomb threat. Literally the lowest bar on earth. What did it do, Scott? Refused. J.D. Vance, over the weekend, was confronted by Dana Bash of CNN. Double down on the conspiracy theory. This was after they were told that there were bomb threats, schools have been closed down, universities are closing down, parades are closing down, the Haitian community has reported being targeted, there's been swatting incidents. They want to incite violence. It is a violent extremist movement. And the term that I use, stochastic terrorism, which I've been using for several years, and I hope people get familiar with it, is when public figures or media channels paint a target on a specific individual or community, which leads to random but predictable acts of violence. With Trump, I'll give you a few examples. January 6th violent insurrection. the attack against law enforcement, the attack against teachers, the attack against poll workers, the attack against Nancy Pelosi's husband, Paul Pelosi, and speaking about, you know, ratcheting down the temperature, even as he was wearing the diaper on his ear at the RNC after surviving an assassination attempt, he still mocked Nancy Pelosi and Paul Pelosi, right? Media. We've seen the pipe bombs sent by Cesar Sayoc, a Trump supporter, against all of the Trump's enemies. He sent pipe bombs. And now we're seeing the Proud Boys, whom he told to stand back and stand by at the 2020 presidential debate. And they did. They showed up on January 6th. Guess where they're showing up now? They're now intimidating the community members of Springfield, Ohio. And the question that I have then for Scott, for you and your audience, is when will the majority say enough? And why the double standard? Why isn't law enforcement stepping in? Why aren't our institutions saying enough? Why aren't we using the R word, racist? Why aren't we using the T word, terrorism? And the reason is, it's because it's Republicans. And we all bend the knee to the right-wing rage of an aggrieved minority that wants to take us back to 19th century.
Thanks for that, Wajahat. I did want to close with this question. Whether or not Donald Trump is defeated in the 2024 election and whether or not he's sentenced to prison for his many crimes, the MAGA movement that he launched with its core beliefs in white supremacy, political violence, and authoritarianism is in control of one of our nation's two major political parties and remains a serious threat to democracy and civil society. How should the pro-democracy movement in the U.S., which I think is actually a thing right now, how can it most effectively deal with this threat in the guise of the Republican Party?
I agree with you. I believe you have to be aware, and I believe you have to temper your expectations. Anyone who thinks that Kamala Harris's win in 2024 will automatically defeat MAGA is not paying attention. This is going to be a long-term 10 to 15-year project. You have to become aware, create communities. You have to find allies, and then you have to run for office. We have to defeat them at every level, local level, state level, national level. Project 2025, the GOP blueprint for an authoritarian right-wing movement, is not limited to the presidency. I want to stress that. Project 2025 is the blueprint for Republicans all over the country, wherever they get power. So think about chipping away, chiseling away, chiseling away, chiseling away, weakening them, weakening them, weakening them. And the first thing that you have to do is to get a majority coalition to come out and defeat Donald Trump. Then you have to defeat them in the Senate, the House, the governorships, and in local state legislatures and the city halls. They're becoming so toxic that they realize that they're not going to win the majority, so they're resorting to cheating and violence. So if you can get the majority, a multiracial, multicultural majority, to start flexing and start showing up and start winning, this is how we defeat them in the long run. And eventually, I believe, Scott, they'll be so weak that they'll have to cry uncle. But this is the death rattle of white supremacy, and the death rattle has turned into a death march, and they will be very loud before they're put to bed.
That was Wajahat Ali, creator of the Left Hook Substack page and author of the book Go Back to Where You Came From and other helpful recommendations on how to become American. Find links to Ali's commentaries by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Over 13 weeks, the Summer of Heat on Wall Street climate protest campaign targeted Citibank headquarters in Lower Manhattan because Citi has been the biggest investor in new global fossil fuel projects since the 2015 Paris Climate Accords. That landmark agreement aimed to keep global heating below 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, but the world is now getting dangerously close to that threshold. Exceeding that temperature raises the likelihood of climate destabilization, chaos, and greater suffering, especially in countries in the global south that have contributed the least to the problem. On the last day of the Citibank protest action, September 5th, 50 people were arrested in nonviolent civil disobedience actions. At the same time, dozens of others acted out what organizers described as militant joy. As a band played, activists danced, sang, and carried out other acts of creative resistance. During the three-month climate protests, 450 people were arrested, a total of 700 times. One individual as many as 14 times. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus participated in the Summer of Heat protest and was arrested in nonviolent direct actions, such as blocking the doors of Citibank's building. She spoke with Alec Conan, executive director of the group Stop the Money Pipeline, one of the convening organizations of the protest campaign, as they waited for activists to be released from jail on September 5th.
But that's been really inspiring to see people who care about this enough that they're willing to show up and get arrested for engaging in civil disobedience, not just once, but over and over and over again, because that's what it's going to take to move these incredibly large, powerful institutions who are complicit in the crisis that is threatening all of us and ecosystems around the world. And that kind of dedication has been one of the real highlights of the summer for me.
And you talked about the theme or the emotion of today's action of as militant joy. And I didn't get arrested today, and I was in the plaza, and I was dancing to Stayin' Alive and just seeing people. Like, I saw a mother and daughter that were dancing. They were actually dancing with us part of the time because they're part of Extinction Rebellion. But it was just so beautiful to see, you know, two generations together, you know, supporting each other and in the fight together. I just was kind of blown away. I know you can't say what the impact will be based on like the end of the summer, because we don't know what the impact will be. We know that Jane Fraser, the CEO of Citibank, has not met with anybody from Summer of Heat. And, you know, we know that they, as the summer went on, they seemed to get more and more annoyed. And you, among others, were arrested on completely bogus charges. You know, even though it's early to say, just judging from where things are right now, what do you think about the success of the campaign?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's several different ways to measure success in the campaign. I mean, one thing we were really trying to do here was to grow the climate movement and grow the number of people who are dedicating their energy and their time to ending the era of fossil fuels. And it's been so heartening to see so many people who are new to the climate movement getting involved this summer. Literally dozens of people who have shown up and played leadership roles in the campaign, many of whom are new to the climate movement altogether. That's one way that we measure success, is like, are we building power, are we building community, so that then for the next campaign we're even in an even better position to run it even more effectively. And then on the more concrete and narrow goal of moving Citibank away from the fossil fuel industry, look, we're under no illusions that moving one of the world's largest banks to stop doing business with one of the world's most powerful industries is no small task, and we were never going to win that over the course of the summer. But this is a multi-year campaign that we'll be pushing on for as long as it takes, and we will be paying very close attention to what Citi's fossil fuel financing has looked like this summer and this year, especially as we look ahead to 2025 and start thinking about how we're going to be campaigning in the months and years ahead.
Right. I know you were trying to raise, I can't remember the amount, a lot of money, and I don't think you've reached your goal yet. So money for, I guess, to pay staff, money for all the accoutrements that people have needed for the different actions, and money for pizza when people get out of jail. So what can people do? Where can they go if they want to contribute to help pay for this amazing summer-long effort?
Yeah, I appreciate that question, because, you know, we have significant, a campaign like this has a significant number of costs in addition to the ones that you mentioned. We also have lawyer fees that we have to pay for supporting people for going to court. We've also had a beautiful movement space where we've held trainings and meetings all summer long. And so we have been running a grassroots fundraiser. And if you type fundraiser.com Summer of Heat, you should be able to find that. Or you can just go on to stopthemoneypipeline.com and find a way to donate there as well.
Great. Is there anything else you want to say?
Just I would encourage anyone listening to get involved in the climate movement. The fight to end the fossil fuel era is going to be the fight of our lives, and we need many, many more people to get involved. So if there's anyone out there who's listening who hasn't already got involved with a local climate group or isn't already plugged into their local climate activist community, I would hope that the Summer of Heat can play any role in inspiring you to get out there and do what you can. That would be a huge accomplishment.
That was Alec Conan, executive director of the group Stop the Money Pipeline, one of the convening organizations of the Summer of Heat on Wall Street climate campaign. Learn more about the Citibank protest and what comes next by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.com. www.justourspodcast.org. In 2023, Rebel singer-songwriter Billy Bragg celebrated 40 years of making music and political activism with the release of a 14-CD box set titled The Roaring 40. Over his career, Billy's developed a unique sound, incorporating many genres of music into his songs, ranging from traditional folk to punk rock, featuring both stirring protest and solidarity anthems and deeply personal reflections on his own sometimes tragic life experience. Among the highlights of Billy's career was collaborating with Woody Guthrie's daughter Nora and the band Wilco in the 1990s to record Mermaid Avenue, three albums of unheard lyrics written by the legendary radical American folk singer, set to new music. Billy's most recent album is titled A Million Things That Never Happened, and he's the author of the best-selling book Roots, Radicals, and Rockers, How Skiffle Changed the World, and The Three Dimensions of Freedom. Your reporter spoke with Billy Bragg as he was preparing for the next leg of a U.S. tour, where he reflected on his career and the political activism that inspired many of his iconic songs of protest and solidarity.
I was politicized by Rock Against Racism in 1977 during punk rock. I went along to the first big Rock Against Racism gig, The Clash were playing, Tom Robinson, Steel Pulse, X-Ray Specs. And that kind of politicized me in that sense. But in 1984, I just put out my first album. I was kind of a solo singer-songwriter out of the punk mode, but also with some points of reference with the classic 60s singer-songwriters who were also writing about topical issues. And I thought to myself, well, you know, I fervently believed that music could change the world. And now I had an opportunity to find out if it can. Obviously, this was my fight. This was my class that was up against the wall here with the miners. And Margaret Thatcher was clearly my class enemy. So I was going to get involved in some way. But as a musician who was just coming into his first flush of fame, I had an opportunity to use my platform to do something other than just sell records and T-shirts. So I embraced that struggle. I didn't expect it to last for a year. But it included the year in which I first came to the United States of America in August 1984. And toured opening for Echo and the Bunnymen. And that introduced me to, oddly, Woody Guthrie, because you couldn't really buy Woody's records in the UK. I mean, I knew who he was and I knew his songs, but I'd known them through cover versions. And I was finally able to buy Woody's records. But I was also introduced to the songs of Joe Hill, a Swedish-American union songwriter for the International Workers of the World, the IWW, from the second decade of the 20th century. And I'd never heard of Joe. And I got an album of his songs by Utah Phillips I bought and took that home. And that kind of plugged me into that tradition of union songs. So I suddenly thought, well, you know, I could write a song like this to fit into the struggle that is going on in my country. So I borrowed the title from one of Joe Hill's songs that was on that Utah Phillips album, There Is Power in the Union. And I borrowed it from a song from the American Civil War, Union Song, which is alternatively known as the Battle Cry of Freedom, or sometimes called Rally Round the Flag. I was so pleased to find out years later that that tune was stolen from an English hymn. So it's kind of cultural reappropriation. But that's what folk music is. You take old tunes. I mean, Woody, that was one of the interesting things about Woody. Woody very seldom wrote his own tunes. He often wrote songs to previously existing tunes that everybody knew so that he could sing his songs and everybody could join in. You know, he was that kind of busking kind of guy. So in that kind of Woody tradition, I wrote There Is Power in the Union. And I'm pleased to say it resonated. It gave me the experience of going and playing in the coalfields in the north of England, in Scotland, in South Wales, forced me to start to try and articulate the views I had in a more ideological way than I had hitherto. So that led me to Right Between the Wars, Which Side Are You On?, Power in the Union, those kind of more ideological songs that I probably wouldn't have written had it not been for my experience during the miners' strike. So it kind of, the experience of the miners' strike defined what most people think of as what Billy Bragg is, a singer-songwriter with a socialist politics who's standing on a picket line singing songs. And I do still do that. But it's not the only thing I do. That's only part of what I do.
Through your years of writing and performing songs, these four decades, you've understood more than most the power of music and the fight for social justice. And you've used that power in the writing of your songs. I've read that you don't necessarily believe that music can change the world, but it does have the power to communicate important political and deeply personal messages that can bring people together, as you just said a moment ago, and provide a sense of solidarity, like in a union or a strike or any of these moments in time where people come together. And it's powerful. Music is so powerful, and it communicates in a different way than words. And I know you've articulated this in many ways. I wonder if you just share with our audience the power you see and have used and experienced in music.
My sense of the power that music has is based on my own personal experience at Rock Against Racism. I went to that gig because I was against racism, but also, you know, the Clash were playing, as I mentioned, Tom Robinson. But when I got to the venue, we marched through East London to a park, Victoria Park in Hackney. There were 80,000 kids just like me. And I realized that day that I was not alone in my concerns. From a gig, you can take a sense of communion, a sense of connection, a sense of solidarity around an issue that's being articulated at that moment that fires you up to go away and put into practice your beliefs, that can recharge your activism. Mm-hmm. And that's my job every night. That's what I'm trying to do. Because I'll tell you what, when I come off stage after that audience have all sung There's Power in the Union with their fists in the air, my activism is really recharged. I'm 100%, you know, and my cynicism is temporarily kicked to the curb. Right. And my job, as well as entertaining people and selling them a T-shirt, is to send them home with their activism recharged as well. And I think that's a much more powerful thing than the idea of me singing a song is going to change anything.
That was Rebel singer-songwriter Billy Bragg. Find a link to his website where you can get more information on his U.S. tour, his music, books, and recent articles by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WZMO in Marion, Ohio, KKFI in Kansas City, Missouri, KPRI in Pella, California, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.